Welcome, everyone, to Awaken Talks. The purpose of these calls is to hold conversations and explore ideas at the intersection of social change and inner transformation. We have a very special guest today that many people are very excited about. His name is Venkat Krishnan. The hour is slated to be an open-ended conversation. Venkat and I have been friends for a long time and explored similar ideas for a while as well. But at any point in between our conversation, if you have comments or questions, you just have to hit the, you know, submit the form on the live stream page, or you can always email ask@servicespace.org. We have an entire crew of very inspired volunteers, and they're going to try to make sure that we're in harmony with the technology gods, because, you know, you never know how this is going to go. Before we get started, though, we want to anchor ourselves in a minute of silence, as we always do. So just a minute of silence before I introduce Venkat and we get into our conversation. Thank you again. My name is Nipun Mehta, and today I'm delighted to moderate a conversation with a dear friend and an inspiration, Venkat Krishnan. Venkat, I think, as most of you have know, he's most known as a founder of Give India, that has facilitated crores of rupees worth of donations for the NGO sector. He's also pioneered very mass movements like the Mumbai Marathon and Dan Utsav, also known as Joy of Giving Week in its early days. And it's really been to inspire generosity, whether it's through money or time. His work has directly, or I would say his work has impacted directly or indirectly, millions of lives. He is a hero to the entire nonprofit sector in India. And he doesn't much care if you know his name, but what he does care about is that you engage with the values and the work that he has initiated. He's the kind of guy, he'll donate blood, he'll take the rickshaw over a cab, he'll eat at home and save the money so he can give it to others who are in need. In his early years, I don't know if this is true, Venkat, still, but in his early years, he was known to live out of just two bags. He's a simple person. And yet what is perhaps most impressive for me, having known him for a couple of decades now, is the longevity of service. He's been at this for a long time now, in one way, shape, or form. And given his credentials, he could have done anything, but he's choosing to do this really remarkable work with an untiring mind. So it's a real joy and an honor to know Venkat and to have him in this conversation. And I should add, before I get to the first question here, of the infamous story, which I was just reminded of, because we just got a comment from Jayeshvai in Singapore. And I think the first time Venkat and I really got to know each other, maybe we met once before, I don't know, but this was close to 20 years ago, maybe. Both of us were invited to speak to this very influential group of trustees of a nonprofit. I think Jaya Bachchan was like one of their trustees, and we were both going from Mumbai to Mathiran. And so we're like, let's carpool. And so we're sitting in a cab together and we really started chatting. And I think that was the first deep conversation we had. And I think what we figured out, and that's always been the case since then, I think what we figured out is Venkat was an outcome guy and I was a process guy. At least that's how everybody put it. And now that we've spent many years doing this, I think both of us would say that, of course, it's not either or, right? It's a yes and. You need the process to get to good outcomes and you need the outcomes to make sure you're following the right process. But we've always had this, we've always teased each other about it over the years. And my claim to fame, Venkat, this is true. I say that, look, Venkat is willing to give me an agenda-less meeting with me. So I don't think he has that with too many people, but I'm delighted that we have these no reason conversations. And Venkat, I'm delighted to welcome you to another agenda-less conversation. Thank you for joining and and being here and for your lifelong work.
Hey, thanks, Nipun. I'm wondering whether you are actually using a virtual screen because I can't see the halo around your head.
Yes. So Venkat, before we start firing each other with questions, I wanna lead off with a question, and the question is really about the current state of the world that we're in. And you know, we are in the pandemic, we're in a lockdown, its effects are disproportionately distributed. I think I want to start there and say and ask you that this is clearly a game changer, but which game is it changing and which direction is the change going in? And I think there's a lot of question marks around that. You're tuned into so many data points on the ground, as well as at the systems level. So from your lens of India, what do you see? What are the challenges, but also like, where do you think there are opportunities? How's that for a nice to see you, Venkat?
I think the impact is at so many different levels and in so many different areas that I'll try and stick to the areas that we know a little more about. I think on the downside, the big impact is how many millions of people it's going to push back into poverty in a country like India. You know, in one fell swoop, I think no government policy had the capability of causing as much harm as this one pandemic has. Estimates vary between, 100 to 300 million people getting pushed back into poverty, which is roughly 8 years of work of, good work that it takes to bring that many people out of poverty are going to go back. So it's like, one step forward, but 8 steps back kind of a thing. So that's one big challenge, I think, that you see here. Also on the positive side, if you ask me, every time there is a large scale natural disaster, you can always see human generosity coming forward. I've seen that, in the last 20 years through various earthquakes, cyclones, floods, and other disasters. And I, in fact, have almost a cynical joke that, every time there's a disaster, the nonprofits will thrive kind of a thing, because there's huge outpouring of generosity and willingness. But I think this time it's been a lot more different than it is in a traditional disaster, in the sense that the generosity has not just been with people going out and giving money, which they always do during every disaster, but I think in an unprecedented way, people have actually volunteered time this time. And just the sheer large number of communities and groups of people going out on the streets and doing their own bit and forming their own groups and, engaging in service to help or to ameliorate suffering of people who've been impacted. I think that to me is really, really good. For the first time in decades, the average Indian middle class has looked at the people who make our lives possible. So whether it's a maid, a driver, a security guard, etc. For the first time, they've looked at them, I would think, at a scale as human beings, as opposed to just, service providers. Many people have had the sense to continue paying their maids, drivers, and other people, even though they did not come to work over a long period of time. And of course, it's patchy, it's different in different parts of the country, but I think at an overall level, we have flipped a certain momentum switch in terms of increasing the kindness and generosity in people. And I think it's now incumbent on people like you and Yogesh and a bunch of others to see how we can, and maybe I can play a small part in supporting you guys, how can we collectively use that momentum and not lose it? Because if people are moving in the direction towards greater kindness and goodness, how do we celebrate that? How do we encourage that? And how do we let people stay on that path instead of, regressing back to where they were earlier?
Yeah, but this is a unique disaster in that sense, that there is no end line, right? Usually there's a disaster, there's a cyclone, there's an earthquake, there's a tsunami, and we can kind of see the end in sight. With this, you almost cannot. And when you have that kind of a vacuum, you also see a lot of people who are in positions of power actually solidifying their power. So you see how, like, you know, the big tech has actually just made trillions of dollars since the pandemic. So their profits are actually skyrocketing. And even in India, you have Jio getting unprecedented amount of investments. So I'm also thinking from a systems level. I've also seen so much. I mean, we started a whole portal called Coronavirus to highlight the stories of good. But I also am curious what you're seeing from the systemic lens. Is it this power grab?
Yeah, I completely agree with you on this thing about solidifying of power. And, you know, you can see that world over with politicians. I mean, we've seen at least a few countries declaring emergency. We've seen what, you know, Bolsonaro and Trump have done there. Back here in India, both at the national and the state government levels, we are seeing greater concentration of power with the authorities. So, you know, in India, for example, the National Disaster Management Act has been implemented. And it is, I mean, your authorities at all levels, whether it's at the central or at a state government or even a municipal corporation level, are able to use "there is a pandemic" as the reason to get away with, you know, the kind of travesties on civil liberties that you could otherwise never have seen.
And so how do you think that the bottom-up upswelling of generosity in people's hearts, how can it not get co-opted by these kinds of systemic levers? Like, what is there a way? Because, I mean, of course, you do so much of this, and you have done this, but particularly with Daan Utsav, where you have everybody giving, but what are they giving if the container is actually, you know, has certain biases, then that giving actually has a very low ceiling, right? At some level, like for even at a technological sort of metaphor, right? You share on Facebook and you feel like, oh, I'm connected to friends, but it's under the larger context of monetizing your conversations and your relationships. And so there's a real ceiling of what Facebook can do in terms of deepening relationships. So in that same way, like, what are the larger systems that you feel, I guess, what should be the relationship between the bottom up and the top down to balance this out?
Good question. And maybe you can answer it yourself as well. What's your perspective? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, Nikun. I think there's two ways to look at it, right? One is that yes, you're right that, you know, these frameworks, the biases, place a boundary on what kind of generosity can be practiced. You know, the only way you can break a boundary is when you get close to the boundary. So my way of looking at it is there are so many people who've been so content being in the center of the plot so far, they've never even ventured anywhere close to the boundary. And the good thing that's happening right now with this coronavirus that, as you call it, that's been spreading, is it at least getting people to venture out from that complete comfort zone into little spaces like that. And I think as people engage in more generosity and as they encounter the blocks, which is where they hit the boundaries, they will gradually start changing. I think we have to give people opportunities to go and encounter the boundary as much as they can. And if more and more people encounter the boundary, then they will start questioning the boundary itself. So I think that's definitely one way to look at it. The second is, I also think people are at different stages of evolution. So, you know, in the larger macrocosm of people, I mean, there are some people who are, like I said, always content being at the center. There were some people in the next circle outside. And we've always had the activists and champions who've always been on the boundary, banging against it, trying their best to push it. And so I think we will need to look towards those people and see how some of us can support those people to help break those boundaries as well. So I think it will have to be a combination of both of these. One is pushing as many people out to get closer to the boundary. And the second is to continue supporting the people at the edges who can help us, you know, break the walls.
Yeah. And so just one follow-up thought and a question maybe before, you know, I want to get into some of your personal story as well, because that's so inspiring. But, you know, this idea of breaking boundaries or reaching for them, there's so many ways to do that. And I think one of the things that I admire most, we both admire Gandhi, Vinoba, is that they didn't really hate the enemy, right? They didn't create this, in trying to build one bridge, they didn't burn five other bridges. Or they tried actually not to burn any bridges, right? So it was, even if it's slower, they went for that route. I don't know how it is in India, but certainly there is globally, and particularly in America, there's this cancel culture, right? There's this this very reactionary approach, and that applies to all people who are trying to break through the boundaries, which you can understand because the boundaries are not serving them or others well. But I think the how we break the boundaries makes a big difference. And how do we go about that? And so to me, I think leading with nonviolence, leading with compassion, making sure we're not creating more barriers in the name of progress feels to be skillful. But you know, particularly in the Indian context, how are you seeing that boundary dissolution? Because if that boundary dissolution ends up just changing the face of the problem, that's not progress, right? Like, so how do we make sure that we're not just changing the face of the problem?
Agree. No, I agree with you. And I think, again, you will need both. See, I do think we live in kind of different times now. And, you know, while one can have endless arguments about what it could have been and what it should have been, I think there are times, for example, during Hitler's Germany, etc., where one cannot be sure whether a completely nonviolent process would necessarily on its own work. I wonder whether you need, you know, both the, and I would not ever advocate violence, but the more aggressive, let's say, the treaty othering of the enemy, so to say, approach of a lot of activists. Of saying that I decry you, I treat you as a bad person, and therefore the problem is we have to overcome you. And, you know, the more nonviolent and longer term approach of saying that I see you as yet another person just like me, and like me, there is good in you and there is bad in you, and my fight is against the bad in you. I think we might probably need a little bit of both. You know, so sometimes you need that aggressive activist kind of thing to unsettle a person who is otherwise in power and completely oblivious to anything else and believes that everything they're doing is right. So sometimes you need to shake them out of that complacency. Maybe a little bit of that is useful. Once shaken, perhaps is a better time to engage them in the longer conversation of saying you and I are the same. I mean, there are behaviors in you that are wrong, there are behaviors in me that are wrong, and let's sit together, build bridges, and figure out how we can work together to overcome it. I think a little bit of both might just be needed.
I
wish that it was possible completely to bring about change without any of the aggression, but I mean, honest, hand on heart, I'm not sure whether it's possible. And maybe that's a defeatist thought in my mind. But I do feel.
Well, I mean, there is actually a lot of data on how nonviolent movements end up succeeding over the longer term and violent movements don't. And there's very exhaustive data.
But on what that is not available is whether there has ever been a movement that was nonviolent in an atmosphere where nobody else was supporting them with violence. If you look at the Indian freedom struggle, so while we did have the non-violence of Gandhi, we did also have the aggression of Subhash Chandra Bose and the aggression of Bhagat Singh and, you know, the Sepoy mutiny and all of that kind of stuff. So we will never ever know with a certainty, mathematical certainty of any kind, whether we could have got that same independence only on Gandhian principles.
At that level, it's very hard to even figure out. Well, you have to find out where you stand and work in that way.
Correct.
But what I find amongst
friends, know where I stand, Nipun. Sorry, I stand very close to Gandhi. I cannot get into that aggression, etc. mode. But what I've come to learn over the last few years is perhaps one need not be dismissive of them. and one can be respectful of that approach also. One can say, no, that is not the approach I will believe in and follow, but one can be sympathetic towards it.
Yeah, and I think that's actually what Gandhi would do as well, right? Build bridges even just, you know, right. Just because you don't agree with people's methods. Gandhi did that even with people that tried to assassinate him. But I think the challenge, and it's actually a personal challenge with people who I actually even, there are many parts of them that I admire that are working to push these boundaries, perhaps with means that I personally am not called to adopt. But I think the challenge is that whenever you have a spectrum and when you are moderate, right, when you're not like binary, when you're not just this or that, the challenge is we use that, like when our anger gets high, we, instead of going on the side of nonviolence and compassion, we say, oh no, this is justified. And then, you know, when we should be doing the other, we kind of, you know, we conveniently flip-flop. And I think that's the challenge. And in that sense, you can end up justifying anything, you know, and so it's, I think this is sort of the systemic challenge. But without breaking that down any further, I want to ask you about, you know, if you look at your journey, it's very interesting for multiple reasons. You started at Sony TV. I don't know how many people know that, but you're very familiar with the corporate world, even Pat after that. Then you did Give India, which is, you know, not the private sector, but the public sector, and working with so many people, so many other nonprofits. And then you did this Dan Utsav, which is, I would say, largely a voluntary sector. And so these are three, is sort of the three major sectors. And if you look at your arc over the last 30 years, you've of course done so many other things as well. But if you look at that arc, it's a very unique lens that you have of the private, public, and the voluntary sector. Can you share a little bit of, let's say I'm a young kid and I'm looking and saying, I want to alleviate some suffering in the world. And I have some of my talents, I want to do something. Should I, you know, is the private sector the lever that I want to kind of tweak? Is it the public sector where I have the greatest bang for the buck? Or is it the voluntary sector? How would you respond to holding those three sectors? Because they're very unique, right? All of them.
Good question. And I'm not sure I know the answer. I'm not even sure there is one answer for everybody, right? I think it will vary depending on the circumstances of the individual, the kind of talents they have, the kind of impact, or even if not impact, the kind of work they would like to do. So for example, I mean, if you're looking at farmers and in India, agricultural farmers, and you want to do something, for example, for them, there are various things you could do. One of those areas, of course, is increasing the ratio of the consumer price of crops to the farmer price of the crops. So today, typically, if you or I buy a kilo of tomatoes for, say, 40 rupees a kilo in a city, the farmer probably gets between 2 and 10 rupees a kilo very often. And, you know, so if the problem you want to solve for is how can I increase that ratio from 4:1, how can I bring it down to, say, 1.5 or 2:1, where the farmer gets at least half the end consumer price or something like that. Perhaps the best solution for something like that is either the private sector altogether. So you build a business that will actually deliver that, or the public sector, where you create, you know, FPCs, as they're called, farmer producer cooperatives. And through that, through a more organized thing with a structured business plan in place, all of that stuff, that's the best way to bring about that change, right? But there are things that cannot be done through organizational structures, whether it's corporate or nonprofit. And I think for those, you will often have to rely more on the voluntary sector. What are those things? I think, for example, behavioral change. Very, very, very difficult to do through organizational structures. Which is why Dan Utsav has never been done as an organization. There's no organization behind it. the idea, very idea. And similarly, I think a lot of the work that you do in the space of trying to increase the level of kindness in human beings, you can't build an organization that is going, who's going to try and create kindness. It has to be a movement. It has to be something that moves from person to person and grows on its own. And so I think there's a lot of those that are much better done through the voluntary space. So I think there'll be, and there are other things like, you know, what are your own financial considerations in that whole thing? A lot of those things also make a difference in terms of which path you choose to go down. What I can say from my experience in all the three spaces is, if you really want the purest of intent to be visible to you, then it's obviously in the voluntary sector. You will not get purity of intent either in the corporate sector. And you will occasionally get a few people who have purity of intent everywhere. But I'm saying, as a larger in general, the purity of intent is far, far, far higher in the voluntary sector, followed, you know, way behind by the public sector. So the public sector does have some purity of intent, but more often than not, I've seen there that once you build an organization, 90% of the times the organization becomes more important than the, you know, the goal or the social change that was originally the purpose of the organization. So you see organizations beginning to build corpuses, you know, worrying about their own sustainability, a lot of other things which actually detract from the larger purpose of solving the social problem that you were out to address necessarily. And of course, in business, you know, personal goals, financial goals, etc., often tend to override even the stated business objective. So I think purity of intent wise, the voluntary sector is really, really the space to be in.
But impact wise, because a lot of people will say, you know, like that famous Ivan Illich quote, the path, you know, the road to heaven is paved with good intentions, or road to hell is paved with good intentions. That there is
that's
this gap.
True. That I completely agree. That's what I said when I said that depends a lot on what your intention is when you start out. So I, for example, I don't think a completely voluntary movement as yet in our society has the ability to help providing the kind of, you know, if I took that earlier example of improving the ratio of income for farmers from their consumer price ratio, I think it will be much, much more difficult to do that as a completely voluntary. It would be far easier to do that through a structured organization, either in the private or in the public sector.
Well, but I mean, it's so I think what you're saying, and of course, that makes sense that you use different sectors to solve different problems.
Correct.
But the question, and you're saying also that if you care about your purity of intent, that you would go lean more towards the voluntary sector.
Correct.
But if you care also for creating external impact, I can't believe I'm asking you impact questions, but. But if you care for also manifesting that, because there is a gap, like we said, even with intention translating into action, that, and I'm not even talking theoretically. Now, I'm asking you, Venkat, now at this age, you have this experience.
Right.
Now, let's say you have three options open in front of you, right? You have somebody saying, here's an unlimited amount of money, go create change. Here is all kinds of political power in the public sector that you can leverage to create policy and have that ripple effect. And you have the voluntary sector option. Which do you think, for you personally, which would you prioritize in terms of you know, having at least a cascading effect? I mean, granted that you may not be able to solve the farmer ratio problem, right? But if you're able to solve more upstream problems, the farmers will also be taken care of. So given that hierarchy of upstream solutions, where would you put your chips in your basket? In which basket would you put them in?
So in that sense, I have already put bulk of my chips in the voluntary sector. So I have a small set of chips in the public sector. I have no chips left in the private sector now whatsoever. Although maybe it might be a good idea in future to go back if I see a need to. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think at a broad level, the root cause of all problems is us as people, right? I mean, all the problems in society are our own behavioral manifestations. We wouldn't have these problems. I mean, in one fell swoop, if if you do 2x of Thanos and if you just remove humanity from the earth, most of the problems would cease to exist. It's when we come that we bring the problems with us. And therefore, I think if you really want to do that complete root cause analysis, I think the root cause is that, you know, we as human beings are not good people, or at least not as good as we should be, or we have the potential to be.
Or that we can
and
be, yeah.
So if you, yes. And therefore, if you really are trying to solve a root cause problem, that is the only root cause problem to solve. How do we make better human beings out of all of ourselves? And that cannot be done through the public or the private sector. They're just not capable of doing that.
I love that answer. I could not have predicted that 20 years after our Matheran drive that we would be here, but I agree. I mean, I also see merit in the private sector, and I see a lot of merit in the public sector to solve very concrete problems. And especially if you have very quick feedback loops, right? If somebody needs something built urgently, like I would choose the private sector levers. But if you're, you know, if you put all that on a canvas, the place where you want to intervene, at least, and for me, I think I would go in the voluntary sector for the purity of intent. But the reason why I would choose purity of intent is because I think there's a toxicity when you compromise intent. There is an internal toxicity that gets created, and we may not be able to map how that plays out into the world. Maybe we just have bad relationships with people around us, but you know, we're doing glorious work outside. But I think that ends up playing a pretty critical role.
So Nipun, but it's pretty much like taking Western medicine or allopathic medicine, as we call it today, right? It's known that every allopathic medicine has side effects. Yeah. But right now, in, you know, there are times where, for example, you know that an allopathic medicine treats a particular disease, and if you did not use it, there is a 99.99% chance that you will just die. And therefore, you will make those compromises. You will take that allopathic medicine. You have taken it, I have taken it, we've all taken that when we needed to. And then once you are slightly better off, you will go back to purifying your body to detoxify it from that impurity that entered the system. So I think there are times where you will have to, and actually, in all honesty, this is making the private and public sector sound like they're some very bad things, which they aren't necessarily at all. My limited point is, you know, different strokes for different situations. So depending on what, for example, I think if the goal is to pull billions of people out of poverty, I think you do definitely need the private sector. I think there is a lot of value in encouraging entrepreneurship, in encouraging wealth creation, and you know, and doing it in a way that will help pull a lot of people out of poverty, empowering people to do that and stuff like that. And likewise, for large scale impact, for example, you know, when you're looking at the COVID crisis right now in much smaller microcosm of the Mumbai city, you know, and you need equipment, you need, you know, PPE kits, you need masks, etc. kind of stuff, and you need them delivered quick. Either you'd go the private sector, but if you need the money and the government moves very slowly in generating money through its processes, then you need the social sector, because that can move much more rapidly with much greater agility than the government and stuff like that. So, and that, since it involves money having to flow, cannot completely be done by the voluntary sector, because then the risks are far too high.
Yeah, in service space, we often use this story of the five monks, where you have, you know, they're sitting down meditating, and all of a sudden by the river, they see a baby in a basket being flowing along. And so they help the baby. And then they, you know, you have a second monk that says, and there's value to helping that child. If you were that child, you would hope that the monk would help you. A second monk says, you know, I'm going to see why we're having a continuous flow of these babies, and goes and says, oh, I'm going to set up an orphanage. A third monk says, well, why do they need an orphanage? We need to have family planning. And so sets that up. A fourth monk goes and says, well, you know, why do we even need that family planning? Because we kind of need more political change. But even that goes away, right? And so then the question is, what is the fifth monk going to do? And so you can, yeah, you know, you can endlessly debate if you, whether you're the monk number four and monk number one, like, should you be doing what the first monk did? You can't just let that child go. Of course you have to help. But at the same time, should you be going upstream? And if you're going more upstream, what is that fifth monk going to do? And to me, I think this is where, like, where Gandhi writes in Hind Swaraj and his vision of a decentralized, distributed, resilient ecosystem. So he's trying to respond at the first monk level to the urgent needs all the way up second, third, fourth, but he's also holding that fifth monk possibility and that vision. And in so many ways, I think we lack that now. And so I sort of want to pivot to another area of expertise that you have around education, because a lot of this is the minds and the hearts of a generation, and education in some sense is the field in which those seeds can be planted. So I, you know, it, for those of you that don't know, Venkat has started a school called Eklavya. He started a curriculum-based organization. I'm probably not describing it right, but it's called Educational Initiatives. And he also, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Venkat, one of your earliest inspirations was a couple of your classmates, having to drop out of your school because of poverty. And so there is this nature and nurture kind of a situation where you have nature you can't control, like all the factors, where you were born, what kind of name you had, what year you were born in. Like, there's a lot of data on how the kind of year, like if, you know, Steve Jobs and I think Bill Gates, Bill Joy, all those guys were born in a cluster of a time when they were in college, like the IT boom happened. And so all those things are nature. You can't control those. But yet you have to hold them in a way that allows the nurture to be most skillful. And education system at its, at its ideal should be doing that. But it's not. And I think the pandemic is also dramatically changing that conversation, but also perhaps opening avenues for dramatic changes as well. And so I know you think a lot about this, you're immersed in this world, but particularly from the India lens and education and planting these seeds and the context of the pandemic, like where do you land with education right now and the greatest opportunities there?
There's two things, right? I mean, education of the heart and education of the mind. One is building the attitudes, values, culture, and habits. And the other is, of course, the more technical skills, the math, the language, the, history or knowledge-based systems. Schools in India have historically never done much on the first set of things, the education of the heart. We've just been miserable failures in our education system, with few exceptions. So, for example, the spiritual or missionary schools, the Christian missionary schools, as well as the, the Hindu missionary schools like the Chinmaya Mission and stuff like that, DAV and some of those schools, they try to do a bit of that values building and stuff like that. But otherwise, the large majority of Indian schools have not, have just left the issue of building values and building ethos to the family. It's been a family's problem, not the school's problem. So schools have traditionally been focused more as skill building institutions whose core job is to teach you language, math, science, etc. And so that's been their focus in any case in India. Right now, in the context of the pandemic, the biggest challenge we're facing is the digital divide, because everybody who can afford a device is able to go online and get some skill building happening through that process. And the millions of kids out there who don't have access, close to 70% of kids going to government schools and low-cost schools do not have a smart device at home or an internet connection at home. And, actually that's higher, more than 70%. And close to 70% is actually the people who don't even have a normal phone access in their homes, because they usually have one phone at home, it's with the father or the mother, and they're out in the field or wherever at work, and therefore there's no device left at home. So there is a slight fear in some sections that if this drags on for a long time, then it might start impacting, and it will increase the divide between the people who have and the people who don't have in terms of the gaps in skills, etc. I think that's one of the worries. We're seeing a bunch of initiatives being started by different people. One of my friends, Osama Manzar, has just day before yesterday started an initiative to try and collect 1 million digital devices by donated by people to help reach them to kids in need. But the reality is 1 million is nothing in a country like India. We probably have 180 million kids who do not have these devices. So that's going to be an issue. There is a bunch of other people, of course, who look at it and say, you know what, we are overestimating the importance of skills in our lives. And, you know, a year lost in a child's life is not going to make too much difference. I partly agree with those people that to some extent that is true. The reality is 1 year lost in a 60-year lifetime on average, or 70-year, is like nothing, right? It's 5% or not even 5%, it's 3% of your life, or even less, 1% of your life, 1.5% of your life. It's not much lost. But the problem is when a kid comes back to school and meets another kid who is way ahead of him or her, so if you're using this 1 year to help build in that child the confidence that don't worry about what you're missing out, and if you're able to use this intervening time to help build the rest of what school doesn't do, build the character, build the confidence, build the spirit of the child, build the sense of curiosity, the sense of kindness, the sense of wanting to do good. I think if we could do that, then these children would be much better equipped to go back to school, even if they are behind in the academics. But unfortunately, I don't know whether we are doing even that. And
I mean, you have so many ins in that sector. I mean, where do you feel is the point of intervention there?
Well, it's going to require a lot of people doing a lot of things, of course. I think, organizations like Teach for India, organizations like Kaivalya, etc., who have large scale reach into the education system, will probably try and figure out institutional solutions to some of these issues. We must keep in mind that even these apparently big organizations will reach only a few hundred thousand children at best. And, you know, we are talking of 280 million kids going to school in India, and 200 out of those 280 not having access to these devices. So I actually don't know the answer to this problem. To be very honest, it's not a problem that I've been able to get my arms around or figure out what one can do. In our own small ways, we've been trying to do a bunch of things in this space. One of my fellow trustees at, you know, this trust that I've set up, India Welfare Trust, Aarti. I don't know if you've met her, Aarti Madhusudan. She lives in Chennai. Incredible woman. She's done two things during this disaster. First, she started a very simple initiative called Call and Connect. The ask was very simple. She reached out to women, said, are you willing to do 3 calls with a girl child who's coming from an underprivileged background, right? It's an agendaless 3 calls. Just be a friend to them. Because we don't know what these kids are going through. We don't know what struggles they're coping with. And just having an adult outside of home for them to talk to might be of use. And she signed up 1,000+ women in, you know, a month, and got them to actually do these calls. Many of them, more than 30-40% of them, continue these calls even 3 months down the line on a regular weekly kind of a basis. And we've seen a lot of messages coming back from both the calling well-to-do people as well as from the children, sharing how important, how useful this conversation has been for all of them. Just having somebody to talk to, kind of thing. The second thing that, again, she did with a bunch of other volunteers together, both of these, all these ideas have worked purely in the voluntary sector, not in the public sector, right? Was the simple concept of, can we help kids learn English through a phone? So if you have even an ordinary phone, not a smartphone, best way to learn language is by talking, right? So can we get people who agree to, say, spend half an hour or 45 minutes every day for 13 weeks just talking to a child and helping them learn English? Because English is an extremely valuable skill in India. And again, she started this about 3 weeks ago. She's already got 1,200 people who are actually doing these calls every day with a child or somewhere, talking to them in English for half an hour every day and helping them pick the language up, which I think will bolster confidence for these children once they get back to school. So they may not have done their math or science or whatever else, but they will at least go back to school saying, I've learned 200 words in English, which I think is incredibly empowering. Yeah. And she's now, of course, trying to figure out how can we take this English teaching idea and expand it to, you know, security guards, auto drivers, Ola and Uber drivers who've been out of job for a long period of time. How do we help these people pick up these language skills as well? So on. Yeah. One thing that we are now trying to do, which is kind of, you know, completely again in the voluntary sector, but trying to build a framework around it, is we're trying to create a 100% volunteer driven mentoring program. Which is basically similar to the call and connect, but it's a longer term thing. So the idea is people sign up to mentor a child for a year, at least, and it can be longer than that, by doing a 1 hour weekly conversation with the child. And it's 100%. So we already kickstarted yesterday 2 or 3 groups. And in the next 10 days, I think we will see at least 10 groups of 25 to 30 volunteers. Who are each engaging 25 to 30 children for a 1 year period. But what we've also tried to do is design this in such a way that it is completely volunteer run, managed, driven, and maintained. So each of these 20 pilots are being owned and championed by people who are themselves volunteers. They do not necessarily own or run organizations, etc. And the idea is to see these as, you know, kind of, I mean, you could call it Amway or whatever, but scalable in that sense. So the idea is you now have these 20 people becoming mentors for a year, but 4 or 5 months down the line, some of those people might be willing to become leaders to create their own groups of 20 people. Yeah. And so then each 20 becomes 400, becomes 8,000 and so on. And the idea is, can we use this to create a million strong, completely volunteer driven movement in the next 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. And actually, if we had more time, I would ping you on this idea of scale and intervention based approach to change, or a ripple effect based approach to change. But we have actually a lot of questions that I do want to get to. If you have extra questions, maybe Venkat will post call also. Respond on some Google Doc or something. So yeah. You're
so, Nipun, my email ID is venkatkn@gmail.com. So anybody wants to write questions,
there you are. Okay, there so you have it.
Post a slide. So if Rohit or somebody could at the closing slide just post my email ID there for people to write to me.
We have a way to email everyone after the call. Since you're okay with it, we'll do that.
Yeah, please.
Not everyone is okay with it. Yes, but we have a few questions. Do you want me to just read them out? Should I read out three of them and then have you respond? They're sort of related, but sort of not. Or do you want to go one at a time?
No, you can read them out. I'll take notes and then, yeah.
There it is. So the first one is from Karan. He says, you know, you say that organizations eventually tend to focus more on the sustenance of the organization itself instead of the goal of the organization. So how do you keep a balance on that? So that's a question. We actually have a lot of them. We won't be able to get to all of them right now, but like Venkat said, we'll get to it afterwards. The second question is compassion is, and by compassion, I think this is Sonal. She's saying compassion sometimes is perceived to be a weakness. And this can be said of all kinds of different, you know, virtues like giving. Yeah. She says, sorry, I'm just, I have to refine it here. Compassion sometimes is perceived to be a weakness in the corporate world. And you're unable to take tough decisions such as downsizing. So how has Venkat been able to balance the goal of maintaining his inner core while achieving his outer goals? And so that's the second one. And I'll leave you with one third one just to presence these voices in. It's that even for targeted changes like Farmer Price, this is Krishnan, even for targeted changes like Farmer Price or alleviating poverty, example that Venkat quoted, that are not direct behavioral shifts, for these changes to actually succeed at scale, don't you think behavioral shifts are required to get there? And in such instances, it becomes a little hard to decide whether to take the voluntary path or the private or the public sector path. Are there examples of organizations that have taken a mixed path that you have seen work?
Good one.
So sorry, that's a lot. I don't know how you'll
No, so once again, Nipun, I think I'll be grateful if you can just forward me all the questions with the email IDs of the people who asked them. And, you know, I'm happy to respond to all of them and I will copy one of you on it. So you can post all the answers in public domain or whatever you think is the right way to do it. So Karan, sustenance versus goal, I actually think they're three distinct questions in slightly different ways, although they may be overlapped.
They are.
It's a tough one, right? You know, how do you, because I don't think it's completely wrong to worry about the sustenance of the organization. It shouldn't be that, you know, because if you as an organization, I mean, let's look at ourselves as individuals. If we see ourselves as vehicles for, you know, depending on whether you're religious or not, if you see yourself as an instrument to bring good into society, or if you see yourself as a vehicle for God to manifest its goodness on the earth, whichever way you look at it, we do have to take care of ourselves, right? We do have to make sure that we, the vehicle, is in good shape in order to deliver what it wants to deliver, the goodness that we seek to deliver to people. So pretty much, I think even organizations therefore have to do the same. They do need to ensure that the organization is in good shape. Because if it is not, then it will fail to deliver what it is trying to deliver. So I don't think per se organizations worrying about their own sustenance is bad. I think the challenge is, you know, the classic tail wags the dog problem, which is that the larger organizations become, the more they tend to get more obsessed about their own sustenance. And that is when it becomes a problem. Now, how do you strike the balance between the two? I think the best way to do it is through periodic deep inner reflections, whether it is at the board level of the organization, at the level of the founder of an organization, the managing team, the volunteers, various levels. If one can institute a culture of deep periodic reflection and just keep asking yourself that, are we in our day-to-day actions and in our strategies and in our longer term work holding the goal higher than our organization? And then individually, are we holding the organization higher than ourselves? Right. And I think if each of us can answer that to ourselves in honesty, and it doesn't even have to be a group reflection, it can be individual. I think we tend to be the most honest when we are reflecting alone. The moment there is a second person, your image perception, your ego start coming into play. So I think if you can build that culture of deep introspection and reflection, that itself is a good way to try and handle that. Of course, the bigger question is, what is the starting motivation? So if an organization has been founded with the intent of, say, making money or with the intent of, you know, being successful. One of the reasons I prefer the voluntary sector, and I, you know, you said this, I like my name to not be visible more and more. I actually find many instances where success hinders change. The greed to be successful makes you compromise on real impact or real change that you want to do. So you will see organizations after organizations that are more hungry for awards, for recognition, for credit. So you will have organizations claiming we impacted so many lives or we raised so many millions of dollars. And if you actually probe into the reality, you will find that a lot of those dollars were going to be donated anyway. It just, you were just the vehicle through which it got routed, but you claim that you raised that many dollars or whatever it is, right? And I think you'll find many organizations going through this. Yeah. So it's also a question of what was the original intent, because if the original intent itself wasn't pure, there's not much you can do to bring that balance, because there was no intended balance in the first place. Sorry, long answers.
No. It's are you able to stay 5-10 minutes, or do you have a hard stop?
I can stay till about 10:05. You know, I have a hard stop. I have a call.
Otherwise, I was going to say that you can skip the other two questions, but maybe you can respond to them quickly since we presence them, because we have some closing thing too.
Sure. Yeah. No. So Sunil, the question about, you know, I agree with you, and not just in the corporate sector is compassion and a lot of positive values seen as weakness, but I also think in the political space today in India and in many other parts of the world, that's exactly what is happening. If any of you has ever met, and I know this is a politically biased thing to say, but that is my personal political view. There is a gentleman called Harsh Mandar. If any of you has ever met him, you cannot meet a softer, milder, sweeter, and more compassionate human being than Harsh Mandar. He is right now being prosecuted in India for being anti-national and for provoking violence. I cannot understand this, right? So this is a problem that will happen everywhere. And I'm sorry if you do not agree or subscribe to his political views, that may be a different issue. I don't want to get into that, but this is the sweetest possible human being who's not capable of violence. To consider him as provoking violence is like, I just cannot understand, right? And so that happens. So that is, I think, when people are scared of you, and this is what happened with Gandhi, right? That people did not understand his approach. And when you don't understand, it creates fear. Fear comes from the unknown, from the uncertainty. So a lot of times the corporate reaction to compassion is fear, because they've never encountered it. So it's natural. We have to expect that it will happen. And the only way to tackle that is to keep being compassionate. So we face this a lot of times in Dhanutsav when we reach out to organizations, to corporates, to other people to encourage them to celebrate. And, you know, when we talk to them and they say, okay, can you, you know, tell us how we can do it? And we give them a lot of ideas. And their first question is, okay, so why are you doing this? What's in it for you? And we say, no, there's nothing in it. And they say, so then what do you want from us? And we say, nothing. We don't want anything from you. In fact, we are here to ask you whether there's anything you want from us, and if there's anything we can do to help you. And for years, we found this now, that corporates struggle to understand this. They just cannot understand that somebody can come and meet you and say, I don't want anything, but is there something I can do to help you? But we just stuck with it. And I think people will start with distrust, but once they experience that your compassion came out of a genuinely good place over a period of time, they gradually, you are able to win them over. I think you need to wrap up, right? So I'll hand over to you. Krishnan, I'll respond to your question on mail, and I'm happy to respond to everybody else's.
Yeah, and we'll put up a Google Doc. There's also a bunch of questions, Venkat, around the project you mentioned with Aarti. People want to participate. There's one question from America of how do we, you know, can you document so we can try to do that in other places?
Yes, we have documented already, yes. We'll be happy to share.
All of those kinds of things. We will have a way to interact with everyone after the call as well. So we want to definitely keep the conversation going. I want to ask you one last question. It's something to the tune of what I would ask you, but since Sridhar from Mumbai has asked this, I'll go with that. He says, what keeps you optimistic, especially in these times when so many hurricanes across most aspects of human life are erupting? So, you know, if you were to look at the larger landscape, so many problems, so many challenges, even compounded, what is it that keeps you optimistic through these times?
I think, you know, the goodness that I've seen in so many people in the last 3 months, the extraordinary acts of kindness that people have displayed, the kindness and courage. I mean, whether it is just, you know, we've already spoken a lot about doctors, but, you know, Mumbai has this public bus transport system called BEST. And for the last 3 months, nearly 20,000 of these drivers and conductors have been going out every day and doing their jobs. They have not said, I am at risk of contracting the disease, but I'm going to stay home. Or if you look at all the sanitation workers, all the public health workers, I mean, we've lost, I mean, while it's all nice to criticize government, we've had many government officials dying of COVID because they were out there in the line of duty. I think there's a large number of people out there who've shown enormous amounts of courage in doing what they have done. A lot of them have done it not because they needed the money, but because they thought it was the right thing to do. And that's courage. And I think a lot of people have done it out of compassion and kindness. I mean, including volunteers, including many of these people. And I think as long as we can see that, I get the confidence and the hope that if we can just focus on that, and if we can find a way of helping that grow, you know, then together we shall overcome.
Beautiful. Before we go, there's a bunch of appreciative comments as well, Venkat. Prior to it, you know that a bunch of your fans are also volunteers with Service Phase and are volunteers here. So they did some fishing around, and
Can you do this after I'm gone?
I'm just going to read one small thing. Okay. I think it's just very emblematic of who you are. This is from Narayanan Vagul, who of course was a Padma Bhushan awardee in the banking and finance sector. He wanted to leave Venkat a comment. He's one of the many people tuned in right now into this conversation. And here's what he says about Venkat. He says, he looks ordinary, but in fact, he's an extraordinary individual devoted to and working for betterment of society. He looks ordinary, but he's a missionary who single-handedly created a movement for spreading of principles of philanthropy in the length and breadth of India. He looks ordinary, but he is a sage who has transcended greed and works for a cause and not for applause. He looks ordinary, but he embodies all the virtues I aspired for but never could fully achieve in my life. May he continue to be blessed. And I think, Venkat, we all, even those who don't know you, would certainly double down on that last comment. That may you continue to stay blessed and keep creating ripples. Whichever monk you feel called to do, I'm sure it's gonna create these wonderful ripples. So thank you so much for you know, this conversation, for your friendship, and most importantly, for what you have facilitated for the world. So thank you. I'll give it to you for closing remarks here, and then after that we'll do a minute of silence. So sure. I know you have to go in 60 seconds, but
Nipun, thanks for I am a little emotionally overwhelmed. Mr. Vagul is like God to me, I'm deeply touched by his comments. Grateful for the opportunity for this conversation. I've enjoyed every interaction with you. It stimulates, it provokes in different ways. And I think that's really wonderful. And a big thanks to everybody out there who, you know, decided to spend an hour of their time listening to two friends just chat. I hope it was of some use to you at least. And thank you. Please keep doing the amazing stuff that each one of you does. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We'll just do a minute of silence in the spirit of gratitude for all the forces that have allowed for so many blessings to be created. So just maybe 60 seconds in silence here. Thank you all for joining, and we look forward to staying in touch.